From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. President Obama cracks down on executive pay at banks getting a federal bailout. The president's stimulus package is running into more opposition as the price tag grows. Even the Democrats acknowledge it's dead in its current form. So what's next? Plus, two more of President Obama's top cabinet picks pull their names from nomination over tax problems. He takes the blame, but where does that leave his fledgling agenda? Here to help us break it down, we have Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She is an author and a nationally syndicated columnist. And Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. Donna, Robert, nice to have you back.
Thank you, Tony. Great to be here.
Let's begin with this. President Obama announced this morning that executives at companies that receive bailout money will have their salaries capped at $500,000, a cool half mil, Robert. The question is this strictly cosmetic or will it have some significance to his overall stimulus plans?
Well, I think they're sort of separate issues, and I think it's in certain ways it's cosmetic, but you know the fact is if you're in a sense going to go on the dole, as some of these companies are by taking billions in taxpayer relief, you're going to be stuck with whatever strings the federal government puts on it, and so you're going to end up with caps on executive salary. But I think the real issue, of course, though, is the stimulus package, and it's just kind of metastasized to a point that a lot of serious chopping has to be done before it can pass.
So let's talk about the stimulus package, Donna, which is getting beaten up on the Hill, and in a bipartisan way, by the way, with Republicans and Democrats balking.
Now there's the bipartisanship we've been looking
for.
At
some of the, let's call them, non-essential elements in the billowing $900 billion proposal. Now, I heard, Donna, that Senate Democrats met just last night over what to cut. Something has to happen, doesn't it, or this deal is dead, right?
Well, before I comment on the stimulus package and the status of it, let me just say this about the cap of $500,000 for top executives at companies that receive large amounts of bailout money. When the Bush administration gave the auto industry a lifeline, they said, part of the quid pro quo was to renegotiate or review the labor contracts. So if workers are asked to sit back at the bargaining table to reduce their pay, their benefits, there's no reason why executives shouldn't do the same. So with that said, there's a lot of good in this stimulus package. We've cherry-picked it to death. We've cherry-picked it to the point where we're now trying to use what I call 20th century terms to describe problems that we're still faced with in the 21st century. This shouldn't be about how many votes we get, but how many people we help. How many homeowners will we help stay in their neighborhoods? How many jobs will we preserve or create? The battle up on Capitol Hill is an old fight. It's a left versus right fight versus how can we help people right now with saving their jobs and making sure that we can get this economy moving once again. And I hope that the Senate Democrats will cut out any unnecessary spending. I hope the Senate Republicans will not just say we want more of what we had over the last 8 years because clearly it didn't work.
Yeah,
but President Obama will have to show leadership.
Well, he's going to have to go and stop
giving them cocktails and give them some hard work to do.
Hold on a minute, Robert, because the president, I think you and I are going in the same direction with this, believe it or not. The president says that certain items were non-negotiable, but that he was open to jettisoning some others. So my question for you, Robert, is why put them in the bill to begin with? And is this a negotiating ploy? And can the country afford to endure such back and forth bickering?
I think the president who, you know, came in with a greater majority vote than any other Democrat going back to Lyndon Johnson. I think he has just given way too much deference to Congress, particularly congressional Democrats from day one. Now, obviously, we all know from our civics lessons, you know, that the legislation has to start in the Congress and so forth before the president signs it. But any president can send a signal in terms of working with congressional leaders as to what his specific priorities are and basically said, this is what I definitely want in the bill, and this is what I would rather not have in the bill. Instead, he sort of just let Congress go willy-nilly writing this thing, and then suddenly when embarrassing things pop up, like contraceptives and things like that, and he's had to sort of come by and say, oh, no, that can't be in there. That's going to have to be yanked out. And now the European Union is upset because of some of the trade stuff that's in it. I just think that he really needs to sort of kind of put his foot down and says, you know, get rid of the extraneous stuff and let's do a bill that can pass. And as Donna said, you know, get it to people that need it.
Well, Donna, are you surprised that he hasn't really done that so far, at least not publicly, put his foot down and said, this is what we need to do, this is what we don't need, and this is what I want?
Well, as a former legislative staffer, and my colleague here on NPR is also a former Hill staffer.
We've suffered through the trenches together. Yes.
Let me just say this. In respect for the legislative branch of government, they have a job to do as well. I've never seen a perfect piece of legislation. Every bill passed under Clinton, under Bush, Reagan, go back as far as you want to go. You can find some of the most interesting legislation on defense appropriation bills that have nothing to do with defense. So let's just be clear that the legislative process is a messy process. But on the other hand, I think President Obama has reached out. He has told the House and the Senate, Democrats as well as Republicans, that he wants a bill that will focus on the urgent crisis that we face with this economy. Unfortunately, members will always be members. They will always listen to their constituents and try to add more items. But I think we're at a point now where the president must say, this is what I want now, and rally the American people and see if Congress can come up with a clean bill.
Well, that's certainly what he is attempting to do by going and doing all these interviews. Let's talk about leadership from another perspective in the time that we have left. Two more of the president's cabinet picks have withdrawn their names from consideration: Chief White House Performance Officer Nancy Killefer, and perhaps more critically, Tom Daschle, the president's choice to lead the Health and Human Services Department. Now, Donna, you're a strategist. Some of these withdrawals that we've gone through can perhaps be forgiven, maybe like former Commerce pick Bill Richardson, because of when they happened and what was involved. But then you get Treasury Secretary Geithner, now Daschle, although Geithner remained, over taxes. There had to have been time to discover this, wasn't there?
Well, you know, this is very unfortunate because Tom Daschle is a decent and honorable public servant who has served the country well for over 30 years. But that doesn't excuse the fact that once he found out about this problem, somehow or another he left it to his accountant to fix it. And so he is paying the ultimate price. And I am saddened by this episode, but President Obama said on his inaugural day, he said, we are entering into a new era of responsibility. And let me add, it starts at home. It starts with his cabinet and all his administration. We can't ask the American people to sacrifice and to be more responsible if people who are in charge are not leading by example.
Well, the president took responsibility for this, Robert. Do you think that was the right thing to do? And secondly, what will this do to his health care reform initiative now that he's losing Daschle?
Well, I mean, ultimately, it's going to depend on who he puts in there, and obviously there are, you know, a number of capable people, many of whom I'm sure have probably paid their taxes, that could actually sit in that spot. But I mean, in a sense, obviously, because the buck stops at the presidency, it is his responsibility. But I will say this: Tom Daschle, as Donna mentioned, has been a public servant for 30 years. He was Senate Majority Leader. He should know that the number one rule in Washington is don't embarrass your boss or your would-be boss. He knew about the tax problem as early as June of last year, and he didn't take care of it until right before he was nominated for HHS, which I think, I mean, it's almost an act of betrayal for somebody who's supposedly supporting Obama from the beginning, that he would allow himself to be put in that position where he would end up embarrassing the president like that. And of course, I think also, though, the president has to take a look at who's vetting these people that he's selecting here, because I think the process needs to be cleaned up.
What should we take from the fact that Geithner survived, Daschle did not? They both had tax issues, Donna.
Well, I think it was an issue of timing. I believe that Geithner got away with it because he was the first, and no one assumed that all of these other problems existed with to other nominees. But look, going forward, the vetting process must at some point, the vetting process need to be vetted.
who's vetting the vetting?
Who's vetting the vetters? I mean, this is just politics 101. I mean, Robert and I both know from politics and campaigns that that's the first thing you look for.
Now, this is my very last question. I've only got about 10 or 15 seconds for you to answer, Robert. This is, and it has to do with old school Washington politics. It seems to me that the selection of Senator Judd Gregg, the Republican from New Hampshire, to replace Richardson as a Commerce Secretary nominee on a deal where the governor of New Hampshire says, we'll let him go, but we're going to replace him with another Republican with the filibuster majority at stake. That's old school Washington politics, isn't it?
It is old school Washington politics, and I would imagine that some Democrats might be upset that the Democratic governor ended up being sort of forced to pick a Republican to replace a Republican.
You think?
Don't get me started on it.
Well, the fact is though, Republicans are not necessarily going to be too thrilled with Gregg's replacement, Bonnie Newman, because she actually ran an organization called Republicans for Lynch, which is the governor's name. So she is from the Republican perspective, she's a pretty far left. She's much further to the left on most issues.
Well, let me stop you there. Only because time is out. This is one way the president was really bipartisan, because he made people mad on both sides of the aisle.
That's all he's doing right now.
Members of the Black Caucus are upset also about the Gregg nomination.
Our time is out, unfortunately. Thank you both for being here. We'll see
you
soon. All right. Bye-bye.
Take care, Don. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. That was Jennifer Hudson, of course, singing the national anthem at Sunday's Super Bowl. That rousing performance sparked reaction on websites, chat rooms, and blogs just like ours. Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes. He joins me now for our weekly update. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tony.
So Jennifer Hudson, as we just heard, staged a marvelous comeback on Sunday. It was her first public performance since the murders of her family members. What's been the response online?
Well, people used words like phenomenal to describe it and said Hudson's version gave them chills. And we said, okay, but was it better than Whitney Houston's? You remember?
Good question.
Yeah, back in 1991, Whitney Houston sang the Star-Spangled Banner. It was right after the first Gulf War, the beginning of the first Gulf War. And hers became the standard bearer. It was released as a single. And the consensus, on our blog at least, seems to be summed up by a reader named Daphne B., who wrote, Houston's performance cannot be compared ever. It may almost be humanly impossible to perform better than Whitney did.
Yeah, well, you know, she got a point, right?
Yeah, well, maybe.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. I mean, nothing against Jennifer. She was great.
We're just saying.
Whitney was like, that was something.
Right.
So let's take a tour of the blogosphere, shall we? Former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick was released from jail yesterday. What's the word among our network of blogs?
Well, I think the most colorful commentary on this front comes from Corey Richardson of Vexed in the City. He's a comedian. And he says, here's what the future holds for Kwame Kilpatrick. He says, Kwame leaves jail. Kwame finds Jesus in a dashiki. Kwame moves back to Detroit, Kwame runs for mayor again, and Kwame gets reelected. He says, the only thing trumping black folks' predisposition to mess up is our greater propensity to forgive and believe in redemption. So if you live in Detroit, he writes, move now.
Detroit. Here's another big story. President Barack Obama said yesterday he made a mistake in his handling of Tom Daschle's nomination for Health and Human Services Secretary. Daschle, of course, withdrew his name from consideration amid tax problems. We just talked about that with Donna Brazile and Robert George, but what are they saying on the blog?
It's a huge story in what we call the black blogosphere. The president has talked about ushering in a new era of responsibility and transparency. So blogger Michael David Cobb Bowen expounds on this point. In a post titled Crash and Burn, he writes, I guess the problem with being a community activist for too long is that you actually don't get to know many serious, ethical, and competent politicians in D.C. So when you finally get to the bigs, you have to pick stalwarts from among the usual suspects. The big upside of being a saint is that by comparison, nobody has high standards. Let us pray that Barack Obama can keep that reputation long enough to get through some of the more dead weight inside the Beltway.
Now, Jeff, on tomorrow's show, we're going to take a look at the importance of a diversified press corps in covering the Obama administration. And I understand that a recent editorial on that very topic is going viral.
Yeah, it's on the Huffington Post right now. It's a post by journalist and author Jill Nelson. And she writes this editorial called The Audacity of Whiteness, framing Barack Obama. And so Nelson says, quote, "It's profoundly dishonest and morally wrong that the media coverage of Barack Obama and his presidency is framed by an almost exclusively white press corps." She writes, "As a candidate and president, Obama has made clear the change we need requires sacrifice from all of us. It's not just about black kids pulling up their pants or working harder in school. The less obvious and likely more difficult change must come from the chattering class, many of them entrenched liberals and progressives to whom it has never occurred that they are the beneficiaries of white skin privilege." Now, I've had this editorial sent to me by five different people on five different email accounts, so it's getting huge.
You know, I read it myself, and she's really into what she's talking about there. It's
definitely
a very interesting post. Thank you very much. We're going to talk more about some of those topics on our Bloggers Roundtable coming up next. Thanks, as always, Jeff.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett, of course, is the digital producer for News and Notes, and he joined me here in the studios of NPR West. Now, though, on to our Bloggers Roundtable. Reverend Joseph Lowery apologizes for his inaugural benediction, and has lip-syncing become a national pastime? With us, media consultant Carmen Dixon. She writes the blog All About Race and also blogs for AOL Black Voices, Rob Redding, who maintains the blog Redding News Review, and Wayne Bennett, an attorney who blogs as The Field Negro. Welcome, everybody.
Hi, Tony.
Hi, Tony.
Nice to have you back. So we just heard about the reaction to Jennifer Hudson's Super Bowl lip sync from the blogosphere. Carmen, what did you think?
Well, I thought her performance was wonderful. And the thing is, it's a production. It's a live event. And you want the national anthem in particular to come across as strongly and as beautifully as possible. So to take out the random possibilities of live production, they pre-tape it. I don't have a problem with that as long as she's singing.
Well, you know, what was interesting to me, Wayne, I was watching it, right? And I'm like, this woman is tearing this song up. So why are the cameras not on her? Why am I seeing the football players? Mm-hmm. I want to see her because this is her first public appearance. And it didn't dawn on me that she was lip syncing. And that's why they didn't put the cameras on her, so as not to embarrass her, for us to not see her lips moving when they were supposed to. You know what I mean, Wayne?
Yeah, I do. I do. And I have to be honest. I actually thought she was singing live. I mean, she is a great singer. So I don't even know. As Carmen said, though, it is a production, and I'm sure the producers wanted it to be piped in or whatever the case may be. So I have to admit, I was surprised. Now, I do know at football games, though, they like to get camera shots of the players to see their reaction. But you're absolutely right. There was not a lot of camera on her during the performance.
That's true. So here's my question for you, Rob Redding. If you want to do lip syncing to make sure that the performance is right, then why wasn't Bruce Springsteen lip-synced?
Bruce, that's a good question.
You know, I mean, that was live, so still Super Bowl. You know, what about that?
Well, you know, she's had a hard time of it, and you would think a girl like Jennifer Hudson would want the spotlight. Unfortunately, she decided that she wanted to tape it and replay it back for us. I was shocked to learn that it was not live, and I was even more shocked when people were now asking which one is better, Whitney.
Let me stop you right there.
Let me stop. It's a no-brainer.
Let me stop you right there. We're going to try to clean up your line a little bit, and I'll ask the folks on the other side of the glass to do that, and we'll bring you right back. So because we want you to be heard clearly, Carmen.
I wanted to jump in. I read an article about why they lip-synced her and Faith Hill, which is sometimes getting lost in the conversation.
That's true, Faith Hill.
It's
as well.
Because they wanted those two songs to be clear and inspirational. It's a whole, you can't lip sync Bruce. Are you kidding me? It's impossible. You can't, you couldn't have lip synced Prince. This is impossible. And it's a whole different energy that they're going for, and random sound problems don't matter. But when you're setting up and singing the national anthem and God Bless America, this, you know, millions and millions of people around the world feeling all patriotic toward the U.S., you want it perfect. So,
well, I suppose that's true. My only issue about it, maybe issue isn't even the wrong word, the only thing that made me have some questions is, in order to pull that off, you have to have coordination between the director, the technical director, the camera people, and it's such a coordinated performance. I feel like people are pushing me someplace that maybe I'll go on my own. I don't need the help electronically to make me feel patriotic
it's
to be
TV.
Happy. Well, I know about that. Actually, I do. In fact, that's a wonderful transition to our next topic, television. Television stations are soon going to stop broadcasting their analog signals, although it gets confusing whether it's going to happen next week or not, depending on what Congress decides to do. You know, the House has already blocked it on one occasion. They're still talking about it. But in the interim, while we wait for the leaders of the free world to decide whether we should have rabbit ears or not. What about you now? Do you have rabbit ears at home, Wayne, or are you strictly satellite and cable now?
I have no idea. I have a cable subscriber that's hooked up. My wife does all the electronic stuff in my home. I don't even know. I just want to control the remote. And as long as that bad boy comes on and those channels change, I get ESPN and whatever I want to get, I'm good.
So, Rob, you back with us?
Yes, I am.
So do you have any – some of you must have a little portable TV in the garage, in the bathroom, someplace,
a kitchen
that's not connected to cable. Because if you want cable or satellite, you've got to put a box every place that TV is, and you know what that costs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm so not ready for this. I forget that it's actually happening until I haven't watched television since August, so not on a consistent basis. Just about everything I do is on the internet, and I watch it on playback on YouTube or something like that. So maybe I'll be YouTubing the rest of my life.
You know, something else that's a part of this, Carmen, is when this happens and when those TVs become useless, you know, what are folks, particularly black folks, going to do with those sets? You know, some communities are known for putting, you know, couches on the lawn. So I would imagine that TVs are going to be all up and down the sidewalk in parts of America.
Well, it's even worse than that. When I moved, I had a digital ready color TV, but a big one, not a flat screen. I saved up and finally bought a nice flat screen. But we moved, and so we wanted to give it away. We called four organizations. They wouldn't take the TV.
Yeah.
They wouldn't take the TV. So it is a very good, they didn't even want it. They're like, oh, it's one of those big ones. We don't want it. This is a color Sony TV, and no one was interested. So who knows what's going to happen to those TVs?
Well, I will tell you this from my own experience out here in California. When you want to get rid of a TV or a computer, you have to take it to a specific location. It's not a dump. Well, it's kind of an electronics dump yard, you might say.
But how sad is that?
And you can only do it on certain days of the week, and you have to pull in there, and they take it out of you can't even take it out of your own car. They have to lift it out of the car. These guys are wearing hazmat-looking clothes, you know, and they take the TVs. When this transition happens, it's going to be long lines at some of these places around the country.
Tony, interesting.
Go ahead.
Tony, what's interesting about those televisions and people in the black community having the transition, there are some transition issues because they actually talk about the black community being least ready to do this. So we've covered that in our media section as well.
Yeah, but Tony, you know that a lot of these black folks and these homes, that's going to be a part of the furniture for life.
Yeah.
They're not going anywhere. You have grandparents.
Hey, that's right. Yeah. Right. Put a plant on top of it, or put a picture put an Obama picture on top of the TV. And just leave it there. Yeah, exactly. All right, let's move on talking about Obama. As a matter of fact, the longtime civil rights leader, the Reverend Joseph Lowery, landed in some hot water for his benediction at the inauguration. We all saw it. Here is the closing prayer.
We ask you to help us work for that day when black will not be asked to get back, when brown can stick around, when yellow will be mellow, when the red man can get ahead, man, and when white will embrace what is right. Let all those who do justice and love mercy say amen.
Well, that went over funny with some people, not so funny with others. The Reverend ended up apologizing, Wayne. Rush Limbaugh was one of those who said that he had insulted this country. That was a cultural clash, wasn't it?
It was, because I've actually heard that before numerous times. And I think what got a lot of people in the majority population is the very end when he said, when white will do right. So from what I've been hearing among people in conservatives and people in the majority population, it's like all the other races, you know, you're hoping they'll get ahead, but we're the ones that got to do right. So I guess it didn't fit into that post-racial American message. It kind of separated the white man from the yellow man and the red man and the brown one.
Well, it certainly did, Carmen. I was struck by that.
But I have to tell you, when I watched it, I was uncomfortable with it right away. right away. I was sitting there watching it with my mom in D.C., and I was like, because I thought, given what America had just done as a whole and voted in Barack Obama, I didn't think that was exactly the time to be having that conversation,
it hit a sour note.
I enjoyed it, but I had a sour, and in fact, I was going to post about it and just haven't gotten around to it. So I was actually happy he acknowledged that some people might have felt pained or excluded by that mention.
And that was a mistake, and that it was not an acknowledgement that's some people would believe that we are in a brand new day. Well, we are in a brand new day with a black president. You agree with that, Rob?
We are in a brand new day, but we're still dealing with the same old people. And I think that his comments were very interesting, and I think that they were appropriate. You know, I think we need to come back to reality and understand not all of America embraces Barack Obama as being president of the United States. And we do have a different constituency of folks that are bringing in a new kind of thought into office. You're seeing the church for the first time acting out what happens typically in church, a black church, in a public forum. And so that's the reason why some whites feel uncomfortable. But I think most whites get it. I think we get that there's progress here, and that's what much of the prayer was about. That little part there, I didn't have a problem with it.
Now, this is perhaps an extreme analogy, but in a very mild way, the kinds of things that got Reverend Wright, Jeremiah Wright, in such hot water. His was much more menacing sounding and vehement. But the point was really the same, wasn't it?
It's the same strain. Yeah. It's the same, because I understood what Lowry meant, and I understand what a hero he is, and I understand he has this huge heart for all humanity. But I just felt that note was sour, and I knew automatically how many people in this celebration would suddenly feel let down a little. And I just said, oh, let's not have anyone feel let down today. Tomorrow's fine.
Well, it took a little while, apparently, for them to realize that and for the apology to come.
I think, well, people were talking to me about it that day.
Well, I'm talking about for Lowry.
The reaction was right away.
Was absolutely right.
Because it was a great catch for the African-American newspaper. I believe it was the Tulsa World or one of those newspapers that actually picked up on it and actually followed through with the interview, which is where it was carried, because this did not get a lot of publicity throughout the mainstream press, I might add.
You're absolutely
right. The apology.
Well, we had a good conversation today. I can't wait till we get together again and do this. Mm-hmm. Thank you all. We have been talking with Rob Redding, who maintains the blog Redding News Review, attorney Wayne Bennett, who blogs as The Field Negro. He was at the Audio Post studios in Philadelphia, and media consultant Carmen Dixon, who writes the blog All About Race. She also blogs for AOL Black Voices. She was with me here at our NPR West studios in California. And by the way, you can find links to their blogs and to ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. In the late 60s, when assassinations and race riots shook this country to the core, a couple of guys named Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen, one black, one white, decided that America was ready for an interracial comedy duo. They eventually had very successful careers separately, but while together, audiences didn't quite know what to make of them. Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen call themselves the first and the last black-white comedy team, and they've got a new book out chronicling their partnership called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. Tim and Tom joined me here at NPR News.
Good to see you, Tony.
Nice to meet you, Tony.
You know what? Let's start with this. Let's play a clip of you guys together back when you were doing your routine on the road, and let's talk about that, because I think that really sort of says who you are, what you were doing, and why you're here, and we're talking about it today. Here
1969.
Check me out now. Remember, we brothers.
We brothers.
In the ghetto.
In the ghetto.
All right. Hey, what's happening, Jive? My main man. Say, look here, baby, this way I catch Big Mac. I got to ease uptown, get me some new rags, you know, a couple fronts, pair of gators. Go check them traps. Do a little night crawling through the hood.
That's out of sight, man. I didn't know you spoke a foreign language.
That's ghetto talk, man.
That's the way you talk in the hood.
In the hood?
The neighborhood. Just walk up here and repeat what I just said. Come on now, I'm waiting for the bus. Hey, baby.
Look here, man, that's where I catch Big Rag. I gotta slide uptown and buy a bus. There's some alligators stuck in my traps. I'm gonna go crawl through the night with a hood on.
No, Tom. Don't you ever crawl through a black neighborhood with a hood on.
1969, a black comedian and a white comedian telling that joke on stage. I guess it would depend, Tim, where you told that joke in terms of how it was received.
Well, yeah, well, how hard they would laugh or whatever. But actually, the material worked in both black and white audiences, because you got to remember there was so much polarization at that time. Black audiences just loved to see him screw up their lifestyle, their style, and white folks just loved to see him take the dare and say things that they all, you know, would like to say.
How difficult, if at all, Tom, was it for you to find, because this is race comedy, to find a place of comfort for you in the material that you did with something like this?
I had no discomfort whatsoever, mainly because I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. But Tim and I were very comfortable, as Tim points out all the time, in our skin. We were buddies. We were pals. We were friends. And so what the audience was witnessing, they were looking in on a black guy and a white guy who were friends. We were having a discourse, regardless of what we were talking about, whatever, a lot of our material wasn't racial, but we were having a discourse, and they weren't.
Really?
They weren't. And so they saw Tim and I having a lot of fun on stage.
What was it that made you and Tim decide to put this act together at that time?
Well, we were in the JCs at that time in a civic group, and we had written a drug education program teaching grade school children the ills of drug abuse with humor. We never thought we'd be in show, but it was the furthest thing from our minds. And the program became very successful in 50 states and in 22 foreign countries. JCs used that program as a model program through their publications. And one day, a little eighth grade girl said, "You guys are funny. You ought to become a comedy team." And the thought of a black-white comedy team intrigued us, because there never had been one in the history of America. So we went out and became the first, and as history shows, the last.
It's not often, Tim, that the Junior Chamber of Commerce is a place where entertainers get their start.
Yeah, yeah. Whenever people ask me how do you get in show business, I said, "Join the JCs." They all go, "Ha ha!" I'm going, "No, I'm serious." Yeah, that's a wonderful thing about life. If you're just open for it, and you're not adverse to change or taking chances of. It can take you on a strange journey. And that young girl, she's now a grown woman, and we actually saw on our book tour in Chicago, she came up and introduced herself, and Tom remembered the family name.
Really?
She was a young lady. And you know, interesting thing about it, as we think back from this point back, when she said that, the irony of it is she didn't say you ought to be a black and white comedy team. She just said, "You guys are funny, you ought to be a comedy team."
Wow.
You know, today she'd say you ought to be a black and white
comedy team. Now, the book, Tim and Tom, An American Comedy in Black and White, you look back over what you did. You must be astounded, A, that you did it, B, that you had some relative success with it, and C, that, nobody else was able to do that.
Yeah, that's the part that's really a bit surprising, is that there was, after that, not one successful team, and our two men who, or man, woman, however, that would have enough courage to go against the media vision of what black and white America is, to go against that and dare it outside of sketches on Richard Pryor or Saturday Night Live or whatever it is, it was never done. And it was almost like a built-in taboo. That I find that interesting, because we're so-called such a liberal nation after the civil rights era. You know, we're supposedly all that's behind us. We run into that now with the book. I've been a little bit frustrated that we have not gotten some of the interests of like the newspaper
talk shows.
No, not so much. But the newspaper critical reviews and book, whether they say good things or bad things, that the New York Times book review or the L.A. Times book review actually turned down the option to review the book, because nobody's interested in that. You know, is that sort of so-called liberalism that actually worked against them just reviewing the book. Now, I'm not saying giving us a positive
I
one.
I understand.
Just review the book.
That's why do you think they did that, Tom?
Well, I'm very frustrated. You know, when Tim and I were together, you know, we ran against this resistance all the time. A black guy and a white guy together. We ran against this resistance. We did two national television shows in those days. The David Frost Show, a black man, got us that show, and the Merv Griffin Show, a black woman, got us that show. Today, when we came back together, when we joined together again, just on this book tour, we did David Letterman. I called David personally. We did Jay Leno because Tim and I knew Jay Leno. We did that. We got through personally. We did Tavis Smiley because Tim knew Tavis Smiley. We did Bonnie Hunt because of my relationship with Bonnie Hunt, and Craig Ferguson because of the David Letterman show. The white liberal newspaper, as he pointed out, the L.A. Times would not review us, and neither would the white liberal newspaper, the New York Times, review us. So white liberals who claim to be liberal aren't really that liberal at all. Larry King Show turned us down, even though Barbara Sinatra called him personally. The View turned us down.
Even though we contacted
them personally, we knew people on it, The View. Regis and Kathy, Dave Letterman called them personally.
Actually, I turned Regis and Kathy down.
Okay. So, you know what I say? I say about if Tim would have written the book alone, it would have been a success, or if Tom Dreesen would have written the book alone. But Tim and Tom together, I say this to you. If Barack Obama would have been married to a white woman, he would have never gotten the nomination of his party. Never.
I'd have voted for him.
Yeah, if you read the book, you can find out why.
Let me tell our listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. With me are Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen talking about their new book, Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. Were you really smacked in the face with a snowball in Minnesota on stage?
No, University of Illinois. A guy hit me right in the face with an ice ball. A guy put a lit cigarette out, as you know, you can probably get that. I put a lit cigarette out in Tim's face at a club in Chicago Heights, Illinois, and then tried to beat me half to death. But at University of Illinois, we were in the middle of our act, and a guy hit me right in the face with an ice ball. In the darkness, I couldn't see who it was, and it hit me so fast and so crisp, Tim didn't even realize it. My face was stinging, and I grabbed the mic, and I started calling him every name I could think of that I learned from the white and the black community, and I calling him out, come on, turn the lights on, you coward. And Tim thought, half the audience thought it was part of a...
I thought he was having a seizure.
Half the audience thought it was part of our routine, and Tim thought that and the other half thought I was nuts, and Tim thought I went insane on the stage, too.
Amazing. And Tim, you had an even worse situation, huh?
Yeah, I mean, we were attacked. We were chased out of town. I was poisoned in the city. I mean, it was part of life that we understood was always possible back then. And in a sense that it was part of being black in America and was part of being a black and white comedy team in America. You know, I was raised in a segregated South in Colored Town. And so I knew going into it that there would be some resistance, but you forget that, and you just go do what you have to do. I mean, he was attacked on stage in New Orleans by a white bigot just because he said the guy's city was named after Calhoun, Amundsen, and his lawyer.
The guy said, I'm from Calhoun, Alamama. You know what that says? I said, yeah, that's Amundsen and his lawyer, Calhoun.
Guy went berserk.
Well, you know, I would think, and I'm going to ask you, Tom, because since you were associated with Tim, who is black, just by extension, you became sort of a honorary black person for the time that you guys were together and were treated as one sometimes.
You want to know the interesting thing about racism in those days, and I can't speak for now, but it's probably the same now. In those days, if we were working in an all-black club, and we worked many all-black clubs. There were no comedy clubs in those days, so we worked the Chitlin' Circuit, you know, black-owned, black-operated nightclubs. If a black guy was in the audience and he hated white people, hated them with a passion, he wasn't mad at me. He was mad at Tim for being with me. If we worked a white club or the redneck who hated black people with a passion, he wasn't mad at Tim. He was mad at me for being with Tim, you know. So we always had that kind of – that's where racism was in those days. And we received it from both sides, but it – but on the other hand, 95% or more love what we did. All this in the last election, talking about we need more discourse among the races, you know, and Tim and I were the discourse in those days.
Everybody who was around, or not everyone, but many people who were around when you guys were doing your thing back in the 60s and 70s and so on and further, at some point they get together again just to see, you know, what that would be like. You guys thinking about doing that again, even if it's just for a concert or, you know, putting the routine together one one more time for old time's sake.
You're too old for that. But no, I think we are, in a way, this book tour has done that, where we have talked and lectured and been doing shows, and it's sort of been interesting to not relive, but to be together and talk about that era in today's world. As Tom said, he has some frustrations about how some people in the business, so-called open liberalism in the business, has rejected us. It's not a surprise to me. I mean, it's part of life. It was a surprise to him. They didn't care then. They don't care now. But it is sort of interesting to see race today compared to what it was like then. As we now enter a new era of race, where literally Dr. King's prophecy has come to be that it's about the content of one's character.
This has been great. Let me bring it to a close with a couple of questions. Back in those days, there were what I would call four food groups of black comedy. Mm-hmm. Okay, first one was Richard Pryor. Second one was Bill Cosby. Third one was Dick Gregory. And the fourth one was Red Fox. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's my four food groups
yeah.
of comedy, black comedy. Where did your comedy fit into that?
We were sort of a blend of Dick Gregory and perhaps Bill Cosby. Now, you got to remember, Richard Pryor was not Richard Pryor back in the day.
That's true.
He was a late, that urban view of Richard didn't come until the 80s. Back then, he was an imitation, as we all were, of the great Bill Cosby, who to this day is probably the primo comedy genius. I know Richard gets the credit, but Richard, if I was alive today, would tell you it was Bill Cosby.
Yeah,
Red was by himself. But there were only two other comics doing race humor back then other than Tom and I, and that was Dick Gregory and Godfrey Cambridge, the late Godfrey Cambridge.
Yeah,
we're the only ones. No one else touched race.
It's true. Here's my question for you. It seems as if Johnny Carson really was a king maker for you. That story that you tell about your first appearance on Carson and how nervous you were when you finally, you know, went back and the stagehand was like, you know, you've arrived. Was it really that powerful?
Absolutely. In those days, wherever you went in America, people would say, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm a stand-up comedian. And the next question out of their mouth was, oh, yeah, you ever been on Johnny Carson? And if you hadn't been on Johnny Carson, in the eyes of America, you just weren't a comedian. You might want to be one. You might going to be one. But you weren't one then because he established it. And so the pressure was enormous, absolutely enormous. You'd do one Tonight Show. Freddie Prinze did one Tonight Show. He got a sitcom the next day. I did one Tonight Show. The following day, CBS signed me to a development deal. I went from the unemployment line to having all my bills paid for a year. It was a very, very powerful show.
That's a great story on Johnny Carson and then being recognized in the unemployment line the next day.
The next day. And Tim, when you read the book, you'll find it was a pivotal point in my career, certainly, but a pivotal point. My first Tonight Show was a pivotal point in Tim's career, too, as he was laying up in bed watching me that night.
Broke.
You know, broke. Is that when you were on the floor in the apartment with no furniture, no
that
woman?
Was right that was right after that. I was...
look where you are now.
The book is about motivation. It's about friendship. It's about bonding. It's about hardship. It's about all those things at a time, 1969 and 1975, when America was in turmoil, and Tim and I went across the land trying to just make people laugh. That's really all we wanted to do, and we accomplished that, and we're still here today. You know, and we're still making people laugh. In answer to his question, would we ever get back together? Maybe for one venture, maybe one time for a charity or something. But also, certainly I'd do something on television with Tim or, we do a,
you should do that,
a movie
man.
Together
you should
or something.
Do that.
Well, this is our 40th year in show business this year celebrated. So we were thinking about, we got to do something 40 years.
Absolutely.
God, survive that long in this business.
You've done a lot of things, but I would bet, Tim, that people still associate you mostly with Venus Flytrap.
Yeah. I knew that when I went audition for the job. I said, I don't think I want this job. I don't want to be 60 years old and have somebody say, hey, Venus. And boy, it happens.
The same thing happened to me in respect. I did over 500 appearances on national television as a stand-up comedian, 61 appearances on The Tonight Show. I've hosted David Letterman Show. But everybody always says, didn't you travel with Frank Sinatra? Weren't you Frank Sinatra's opening act? I know I told Frank one day that one day, no matter what I do in life, I could find a cure to cancer. My obituary is going to say the comedian who toured with Frank Sinatra. because he was larger than life. You know?
Amazing, guys. Thank you for coming in and sharing your story. It's great. I really appreciate it. Good luck with this.
Thank you.
I'll call some of my friends for you.
Oh, please do. Please do.
By the way, Tony, yours, $24.95 that you have in your hand.
That was Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen. They've got a new book out about their years as a stand-up comedy duo called Tim and Tom, an American comedy in black and white. They joined us here at the studios of NPR West. If you'd like to see video of our interview, go to our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.